in terms of the that are related to Sefirat HaOmer, you're taking this? Okay.
I tape everything.
Okay. In terms of the minhagim that we have at this time of the year that are related to Sefirat HaOmer, I prepared some mikorot for you. Unfortunately, from the time that I prepared these, thank you, you can pass those around. From the time that I prepared them until today, I happen to have come across some other material that I will include ba'al peh, but are not included in the makarot sheets. Everybody got the jar you have? Any reading eagerly? With beaded breath and exposed toes. I'm glad somebody thought it was funny. Okay. So let's start with something really simple. Thank you. Let's start with something really simple. Let's go back to one of the earliest mikorot that we have regarding the notion of avelut. Any kind of avelut in Sefirat HaOmer, that's at the top of your page. And by the way, when I photocopied these, I meant to have them do back-to-back, and I just forgot to press that button, and that's why we have to waste all these extra papers. Okay, so in Otsar HaGaonim, for those who don't know, okay, has anybody here ever heard of Otsar HaGaonim? Okay, let me tell you a little bit. Anybody know when the Gaonim lived? Ninth, 10th centuries, okay? The Gaonim were really the last gasp of the great Babylonian yeshivot, right? The ones that produced the Gemara. So the Gaonim were at the end of that period. The Gaonim, some of them actually wrote real works, like Rav Saja Gaon wrote a number of works, and Rav Sharira Gaon, and Rav Hai Gaon. So we have like a Sidur from Rav Amram Gaon, and we have some other things. But a lot of the writings of the Gaonim were known to us only because they were quoted by somebody else. They didn't actually sit and write books that we have whole volumes or a Perush on that we have an entire volume of. So it was scattered throughout things that other people wrote. And about 100 years ago, maybe a little bit more, 120 years ago, people started collecting those things and publishing them. So you have a sefer called Tshuvot HaGaonim. These were Tshuvot that the Gaonim wrote that were found in a lot of different places and are now available in a single volume. You have this Otsar HaGaonim, which is, I think, a 12-volume set of things that were collected from what different Gaonim had written and then put together. So Otsar HaGaonim is that collection, and Otsar HaGaonim recounts as follows. Gam minhag b'chol Yisrael shelo lisa bein Pesach la'atzeret. There is a widespread minhag throughout all of Israel not to get married between Pesach and Shavuot. This is the first mention in all of Jewish history of this minhag. Umishum aveluti v'lo mishum isur. Not that it's forbidden to do so, but because it's a sign of avelut. Okay? Shekach amru chachamim, because chachamim told us, shneim asar elav zugo talmidim hayul l'Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva had 12,000 pairs of students, which is an interesting way of phrasing it. Because what would have been an easy way of saying it? 24,000 students. But apparently, they worked in pairs. So we had 12,000 pairs of students. The Chulan Meitu bin Pesach la'atzeret. They all died between Pesach and Shavuot. Shelo nahagu kavod ze bazeh. Because they did not act with kavod one to the other. The Chulan Meitu ba'askara. They all died from some kind of strange disease called Askara. From that time and onward, Minhag emerged to mourn for them. Okay, not to get married during those days. That's the extent of Minhag, and the Otsar Gaonim is the earliest source that we have for this. Okay? As an aside, before I made Aliyah, this goes back 20 plus years, I get a phone call one day from a woman who I didn't know, who asks if I will be the rabbi to officiate at her wedding. That's weird. I was not the rabbi of a shul. This is not something I did regularly. I've only done it twice or three times. I said, where'd you get my name from? I said, well, I'm not looking in the phone book. And I found rabbi. I figured I would call you. I said, when do you want to get married? She gave me the date. I said, you know, that's during Sfirat HaOmer. She said, what's that? So I explained to her a little bit. Well, she said, well, can't you do the wedding anyway? I said, no. He said, well, do you know of another Orthodox rabbi who will... I want only an Orthodox rabbi. Do you know of another Orthodox rabbi who will marry me during Sfirat HaOmer? I said, no. I said, I don't know of any Orthodox rabbis that will perform a marriage ceremony during Sfirat HaOmer. It's strange. The conversation basically ended after that. Well, thank you very much. And she hung up the phone. Never heard from her again. Right? But it's a minhag. It's a universal minhag that during Sfirat HaOmer, there are no weddings. Okay. That's in the Gaonim. If you jump forward about 300 or 400 years, maybe even more than that, you get to the Tur. Okay? Is there anybody here who knows who the Tur is? Yeah, who's the Tur? Okay. Okay, the Tur, otherwise known as the Yaakov Baal HaTurim, the author of the Turim, right? Baal HaTurim and the Chumash is the same guy. It's just the Perush, the Baal HaTurim, is what he wrote when he was in jail and he was bored. He needed to play with numbers so he could keep himself busy. But his real work was writing the book called the Tur, Arba'at Turim. He was an interesting guy. He's the son of the Rush. Some of you may have heard of the Rush. Right? He's the guy who's printed in the back of the Gemara. The Rush grew up in Ashkenaz and moved to Sfarad. So the Tur was familiar with a lot of the Torah from Ashkenaz, but he really grew up in Sfarad, and he incorporated a little bit of both as he wrote his Perush, which became the foundation later on for the Shulchan Aruch. So the Tur writes as follows. Noagin b'cholam, because this is the second source. Nohagin becholam akomot, like this is a universal minhag. Shelo lisa isha bein Pesach la'atzeret, not to get married between Pesach and Shavuot. By the way, you'll notice that they say between Pesach and Shavuot. Right? Are there any exceptions in there? No. Right? The Otzar HaGaonim did not know of any exceptions between Pesach and Shavuot. Okay? You had a question?
Yeah, I wanted to know, considering the fact that like the religiosity of the woman who called you and like her extensive knowledge, the fact that there was no way of her getting a religious Orthodox rabbi to do her marriage during the honor, wouldn't it mean some leniency for someone to have Orthodox marriage during the honor, which is just like a minhag compared to
That's a great question. You want to know if there's leniency? I don't know. I'm not a post-sake. I brought the story, not so that the story could be the focus. I brought the story because it sort of illustrates this. Okay? Anyway, back to the tour. Right? So it's universal Jewish minhag all over. Batam, and the reason is shalol harbot bisimcha, that we shouldn't have too much joy during this period. During this time, the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva died. And this is what the Gaonim taught us as well. Look what happened between the time of the Gaonim and the time of the Tur. Tur is written in the, I think, in the end of the 14th century. V'yesh mekomot shenahagu shalo lehistaper. So there are some places that have the minhag not to take haircuts during this period. V'yesh mistaprim milag ba'omer v'ilach. And there are those who say that it's okay to get a haircut starting from lag ba'omer onwards. Shomrim she'az pasku milamut. Because they say that that's when people stopped dying. It's interesting because he quotes they and them without quoting anybody by name. And that's pretty odd because the Torah likes to quote people by name. Okay. I'm going to leave out the rest of this for now. Okay, those of you who are interested can read the rest of this. So here we have a minhag that first appears in the period of the Gaonim. 500 years later, you get to the Tur. The Tur records the minhag. It assumes that it's a universal minhag, as the Gaonim assumed it was a universal minhag. And added on that there are those who have a minhag not to take haircuts from Lag from Lag BaOmer on, they take haircuts. Does he say from Lag BaOmer on they can get married? No. Meaning haircuts is the second stage of Avelut. And there are those who when it comes to the second stage of Avelut are a little bit more lenient. Okay. We're going to come back to the halakhic piece later on. Okay? I'm interested in taking a look. Do you have sheets? Okay, I'm interested in taking a look at the origins of this Otzer HaGaonim. Okay, the Gaonim record this minhag, and they record this business, the story about the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva. What's the source? Where does it come from? Right? Because, I mean, they didn't just make this up. They clearly learned it from someplace. And it turns out that in Chazal, when I say Chazal, I mean the period of the Tanaim and Amoraim, that in Chazal, there are three different sources for this. And I actually put them side by side so we can compare them a little bit. And I put them in chronological order. Okay, because not all sources from Chazal are identical. Right? Like we know that Mishnah is before Gemara. And Mishnah is considered to be, therefore, more authoritative than Gemara. Right? So I put them here in some kind of chronological order. Let's read them from right to left. Okay? Because they're in Hebrew. Shneim Asar Elef Zugo. This is Breshit Rabbah. Breshit Rabbah is a midrash that was written in the period of the Tanaim. Not all Midrash Rabbah was written that early, but Breshit Rabbah was written in the period of the Tanaim, which means it's one of our oldest written sources. Shneimasar elav zuko talmidim hayul Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva had 12,000 pairs of students. Mi Gvat v'ad Antipatris. From the town of Gvat, which is in the lower Galil, to the town of Antipatris, which is very close to what today is Rosh Ha'ayin, a little bit northeast of Tel Aviv. Okay, this is the area that is being described over here. If I had a map of Israel over here, I don't. Of course I do.
It's good it wasn't double-sided.
Yeah. Okay, here's a map of Israel. Okay, so Antipatris would be approximately over here. Don't quote me on that, but approximately over there. And Gavat would be approximately over here. And this is the area where they say Rabbi Akiva had 12,000 pairs of students. Everybody see that? Now, this is, by the way, north of Yerushalayim, northwest of Yerushalayim. You can have one of these. Because you asked so nicely. Okay. So Rabbi Akiva had 12,000 pairs of students from Gavat to Antipatris. V'chulan, v'chulhon meitu v'feret achad. And they all died during one period. That's interesting. It doesn't tell us what the period was. This is a source that is probably contemporary to Rabbi Akiva, Bereshit Rabbah. Rabbi Akiva was a Tana, right? Lived in the middle of the 2nd century. Right? So this would have been written anywhere between 5 and 50 years after the death of Rabbi Akiva. And it says they all died during one period, but we don't know what that period is. Perek Echad. Lama. And why did they all die? Shaita inehem tzara elu ba'elu. Because they had what's literally described as narrow eyes as they looked one on the other. Anybody know what the term ayin tzara means in Chazal? Yeah?
Narrow mind.
Good guess. I don't think it's correct, but it's a good guess.
Contempt.
Interesting. Now, ayin tzara, there's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot that mentions ayin tzara. Ayin tzara means that you're really unhappy when somebody has something that you don't have. Like if somebody else is right and you're wrong, I'm really bothered by that. Like you have a machloka with your chavruta, you can't stand for him to win even though you know he's right. That's ayin tzara. Okay? My kids are masters of ayin tzara. One of them gets something, oh, what does she get, not me? That's ayin tzara. You could be happy for the fact that somebody got something. It is, after all, their birthday. Or they did, after all, just work 28 hours for it. Right? No, but I want it also. That's ayin tzara. But nobody can have something if you don't have it too. Okay? So, Bereshit Rabbah says that they died because they were ayin tzara. That they couldn't stand having somebody else have something that they don't have. After they died, Basof Hemid Shiva. At the end, Rabbi Akiva found another 7 students. After he lost 24,000, and I don't know what it means for somebody, there weren't 24,000 people learning Torah in times of the Mishnah. I don't know how you get 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva. Meaning, there's just no indication that, right? Talmud Torah was reserved, for the most part, for a small, elite group of scholars. But 24,000 people learning Torah, so I have to think about what that might mean. Okay? But at the end, he replaced those 24,000 with 7. Just a second. And now we have a list of who those 7 are. Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua, Rabbi Yochanan Asandar, Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov. And there's a different opinion that says, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Nechemiah, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, Rabbi Chanina ben Chachinai, Rabbi Yochanan Asandar. Okay. I don't know enough about these people to say anything meaningful or intelligent about them. Amar Lahem. So Rabbi Akiva said to his new students, Harishonim lometu ela shaita inam tzara batura ilu be'ilu. Says the first ones died because they had an ayin tzara in Torah. Okay, this is something new. Before it just said they had ayin tzara, but now the Bereshit Rabbah adds that an ayin tzara in Torah. Okay, what's the implication of having an ayin tzara in Torah? Yeah.
So I do.
I do a minhag or something my way, and you do it in another way, and because you do it in another way, I'm upset that you do it.
Okay, I'm upset that you do it differently than me. Or, if we think about the way this Midrash phrases it, 12,000 pairs. So what was going on? What kind of culture existed in that theoretical Beit Midrash that we're talking about? Yeah? Chavruta-based model. But now, Rabbi Akiva says, it was a Chavruta-based model, but they had Ayin Sara, meaning?
They didn't agree with each other.
Not only didn't they agree with each other, but
they were jealous.
They were jealous of each other. Which means that when they were learning, they weren't learning to find out the truth. They were learning to win. It was a competitive culture in the Beit Midrash, and competitive on a one-to-one basis, and everybody, all they wanted was to win the argument. They weren't really interested in pursuing truth and Torah. And what happened to them? They all died. Do we know how they died? According to Bereishit Rabbah, does it say how they died?
No.
They died a mysterious death. And what does it sound like if they all died a mysterious death, like all in one period? Like, what caused their death?
Disease.
What? Yeah, some kind of divine punishment. Because here they are learning Torah, but they're not really interested in Torah. All they're doing is they're interested in winning. So you have an entire culture of learning over here that's based on who's a better arguer. Yeah? We'll get there. Okay? Let's just stick with what the sources say.
Yeah.
But so many individuals have such a like defined superiority complex, you know, it's all like want to be better than their own like partner.
Right. Well, who do you think that reflects on?
Teacher.
And who sets the culture in the Beit Midrash? Okay. So Rabbi Akiva went to replace those 24,000 with seven, and he tells them the first ones died Chaita Enehem Tsaraba Torah. Hold on. So you please pay attention, be very careful not to be like them. Amdu umalu kol Eretz Yisrael Torah. And this Midrash concludes by saying that those seven eventually ended up filling the entire land with Torah. That's the earliest source that we have. So we have the 12,000 pairs. We have a terrible learning culture. We have some kind of divine punishment that strikes them down, right? And Rabbi Akiva, who has learned his lesson from this.
So at the beginning we say 12,000 pairs.
Yeah.
And at the end we say seven students. Why is it not, it doesn't say students, it's just Sheva.
Right.
So why don't we say that it's really 14, that it's seven pairs of students, just like mirroring what we said at the beginning.
Well, maybe Rabbi Akiva is trying to create a completely different kind of culture.
It's just seven students.
Quality versus quantity. The nature of the learning has to be different, right? The whole culture has to be different. Okay, I'd love to take all your questions and comments. I'd also love to share a little bit of learning with you. Okay, let's move on. Because now we jump ahead about 300 years. Okay? Is 300 years a long time?
No.
Well, if you're writing a history book, you can easily write 300 years. But when you think about where the world was 300 years ago, or where the world is going to be 300 years from now, how much do we know now that we didn't know 300 years ago? Right? 300 years could be very significant. So we move ahead 300 years. We have a Gemara in Masechet Yevamot. The Gemara says as follows. It has its own version of this story. And this is interesting. Okay? Because the Bereishit Rabbah was written in Eretz Yisrael in the 2nd century. And Yevamot is written in Bavel in the late 5th, early 6th century. So this story has now migrated a few hundred miles and a few hundred years. Let's see what the story looks like a few hundred miles and a few hundred years later. Amru, it's been sent. Shnei Masar Elav Zugim Talmidim Hayulal Rabbi Akiva Migvat Viad Antipatris. Rabbi Akiva had 12,000 pairs of students from Givat to Antipatris, same geographical area. You'll see why this is important in a second. V'chulan metu b'ferek achad, they all died during one period, mipnei shelo nahagu kavod ze laze, because they didn't treat each other with respect. Is this the same or different so far? Different? Who said different? What's different?
It says no respect versus the...
Yes. No respect is a lot broader than Ayin Sarah. Ayin Sarah simply means that in their learning that they couldn't allow the other guy to win. But Shalom Nahagu Kavod Zebazeh goes a lot further than that and says that spread, it created an entire culture beyond the learning that they didn't treat each other with any kind of respect. We have more sources over here, you can pass them around. Thank you. Let's continue. V'haya ha'olam shamein, and the world was desolate. Was that in the original? V'haya ha'olam shamein? Means it, right? Meaning, if there are no students of Rabbi Akiva, then there's no Torah being learned at all. The world had been laid to waste. That's interesting. Right? This is how the story evolves 300 years and a few hundred miles later. Ad Sheba Rabbi Akiva, until Rabbi Akiva, oh, he saved the day. Did you hear what happened? Did you hear how Yehuda Mot is telling the story a little differently? Right? In the Bereishit Rabbah, Rabbi Akiva is responsible for the... Right, for the 12,000, and Rabbi Akiva had to find 7 to replace those. But in Yevamot, who's responsible? The students. And who's the great savior of the story? Rabbi Akiva. Right, these little differences, these little subtle differences, make a tremendous difference in the story. Until Rabbi Akiva showed up one day. Achabar Rabbi Akiva Eitzel Rabotenu Shabbadarom Ushina Alahem. Until Rabbi Akiva came to the rabbis in the south and taught them. Remember my map? Rabbi Akiva's first students were all in the north. From Tel Aviv, or just northeast of Tel Aviv, all the way up to the Galil. But it left out all the Chachamim in the south. And there were a lot of Chachamim, not necessarily in Yerushalayim, but in the area of Yavne. You had a core of Talmidim. Yavne, Bnei Brak, right? Until Rabbi Akiva came, and what was the big change that Rabbi Akiva made? What?
He went south.
In Bereishit Rabbah, Rabbi Akiva does tshuva. Right? Rabbi Akiva speaks to his Talmidim, his new Talmidim, and says, please learn a lesson from the past. And, you know, he has 7 instead of 7 pairs or whatever it is. Well, here, Rabbi Akiva doesn't need to do tshuva. It's not his fault. Somebody else. They messed up. Rabbi Akiva saves the day. He travels southwards, and he teaches Torah in the south. So the problem was that these guys were in the north, and the north had a terrible culture, but the south was good. That's the end of the story in the Gemara. But now the Gemara adds one more interesting piece. Tana. Kulam metu mipesach viad atzeret. Oh. Now we have an addition. By the way, the time period, which the first source didn't talk about at all, the time period is from Pesach until Shavuot. Amar Rabbi Chama bar Abba v'itema Rabbi Chia bar Avin. So somebody else commented, oh, kulam metu mitara'a. And the death they died was a very bad death. Mitara'a. Maihi? And what is considered a mitara'a? Rav Nachman comes and explains, Amrav Nachman askara. What's askara? So today I think askara is used to describe tuberculosis. But askara, we don't really know exactly what it is, but when you go through the mikorot, it turns out something happens in your throat and you strangle. That's askara. So they all died of strangulation. Okay? Now, understand what just happened. We traveled a few hundred miles, and we traveled a few hundred years, and now the story gets shaped completely differently. Rabbi Akiva is not the villain of the story. Who has to do tshuva? Rabbi Akiva is the hero of the story. The villain is the north. The hero is the south. And this Gemara now adds something that we didn't know beforehand. This Gemara now says that they all died during the period from Pesach until Shavuot, and they died a very terrible death. And then somebody else comes and says, oh, yeah. I know what that death was. It was askara. Now, why nobody during the intervening 300 years knew any of this stuff is a good question. Which, of course, raises the question of how could Rabbi Nachman know this if the earlier sources didn't know this? And how come Rabbi Nachman is the only one who knows this? Right? Those are interesting questions. What I'd like to do is I'd like to jump ahead. So here we have the earliest sources. Is Lag BaOmer in here anywhere? No. Even the Omer first appears in the Gemara in Yevamot. It didn't appear in the earliest source. Okay? Which is why when the Gaonim quote this, the Gaonim know this from the Gemara. And then what the Gaonim do is they say, look, there is a minhag. The minhag is not to get married. Well, during this period of time, well, what could the source of this minhag possibly have been? The only possible source for this minhag is this Gemara in Yevamot. Because that Gemara in Yevamot is the only one that actually talks about the period of Sfirat HaOmer. So it connects it back to that story. That's it. Okay, so now we have this very strange period of time. We don't know much about the mystery of what happened to Rabbi Akiva and his students. How they died, why they died. The one thing we have is there was something about their culture which was not a very positive culture. I'm going to jump ahead now, another 1,400 years. Let's go to the end of the 19th century into the beginning of the 20th century. People are trying to figure this out. This is when people, starting in the 1870s, 1880s, people start trying to figure out what's really happening here? What's going on? And they try to go to different kinds of documents, different kinds of research, they do historical research, they're trying to figure out what's the story here. So there are, I brought here four different historians, all living between the years 1880 and 1940, or 1880, 1950, during this period. And a huge machloket emerges amongst these historians as they're trying to explain the story of Rabbi Akiva and this business of Sfirat HaOmer. So one of these historians, Aaron Oppenheimer, that's the first one under that box, Aaron Oppenheimer, he writes as follows. Karol Levadai is almost certain. So it's almost certain that that story about the 24,000 students, obviously, can't mean Talmidim. can't mean students like Sussman has students here in Eretz Tzvi. Ein ish mikerv chachamim shayudo tamidim korabim. There is nobody amongst all the chachamim who had 24,000 students. In fact, if you were to take the entire period of the Tanaim and Amoraim together, I don't think you would find 24,000 people learning Torah. He doesn't say that, I just said that. He says, rather, Ella, Belochamim Shehishtatfu Bamerid Behetein Likriyato Sherabi Akiva. He says, obviously what we're talking about is not students of Rabbi Akiva, but followers of Rabbi Akiva. You see, Rabbi Akiva was a very important person, as somebody here pointed out a few minutes ago, in the Bar Kokhba rebellion. Bar Kokhba rebellion, so Bar Kokhba got up and said, we have to rebel against the Romans, 133 of the Common Era. Does that sound about right?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sure there are historians here who know better than I do. 133 to 135, I believe. Or was it 135 to 137? Okay. Give or take 2 years around the year 135 of the Common Era. Bar Kokhba decided there was time to rebel against the Romans. Rabbi Akiva supported him. There was a big machloket amongst the Chachamim. The pacifists said no, and Rabbi Akiva said, yes, we're going to join him. And he said, Bar Kokhba is the Mashiach. You got to follow the Mashiach. Well, 2 years later, the Mashiach is dead, and the rebellion is crushed, and it is a very terrible time. I want to say that the land was shamein, the land was desolate. Yeah, after the Bar Kokhba rebellion, you could say the land was desolate. The city of Beitar was decimated. It was the largest city of its time. It was completely decimated. The Jewish community was ravaged. People either dead or exiled or just destroyed. Okay, which actually sounds like it could be by Yah Olam Shamein. Okay, the world was desolate. Okay, so Aaron Oppenheimer comes and says, "Guess what? We're not talking about Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva, but followers." People who followed his edict to go to battle. He continues, Eidut lechach, I'll give you a proof of this, b'divrei Rav Shmira Gaon b'igrato. He goes back to the period of the Gaonim. Okay, what does Rav Shmira Gaon write? Ve'amid Rabbi Akiva talmidim harbei. Rabbi Akiva had many, many students or followers. Veheve shamda ala talmidim shal Rabbi Akiva, and there was a gzeirat shmad on the talmidim of Rabbi Akiva. Gzeirat shmad meant execution by the Roman authorities. So Rabbi Shmira Gaon, when he writes, which is slightly different from what we have here in the Ozar HaGaonim, Rabbi Shmira Gaon writes that there was a Roman decree. And the Roman decree is what killed them. That's interesting. Ein shmad elamot midei ha-shultonot. The word shmad always refers to a decree by the ruling authorities. So Aaron Oppenheimer writes that obviously the students of Rabbi Akiva died not as a result of a bad culture of learning in the Beit Midrash, which is how Bereishit Rabbah would have had it, but rather they died because they followed Rabbi Akiva into a battle, and that was the wrong thing to do. Okay, that's an interesting twist. Now, another historian in the early 20th century, Shmuel Safrai, says something very similar. So I'm not going to read what he says over here. But now, let's flip the page. Let's go to the top page. Here we have two more contemporary historians, also 19th century. Not 19th, 20th century. They both say very similar things. Let's just pick one of them. Let's do the first one, Gedalia Alon. Nishtayer lanu ladun kitzarot betamidah Rabbi Akiva betafkidah b'milchamazi. He said we have to talk a little bit about Rabbi Akiva and his students and their role in this war. Yidua masorat shel 12,000 zugot tamidim shayu l'Rabbi Akiva v'chulam meitu b'ferek echad. We know about that masorah, they all died in one period. V'ayah ha'olam shamein, he's quoting now from the Gemara, Ad sheba Rabbi Akiva yitzar Rabotinu sheba darom, ushna'a lahem Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, etc. V'inei, Rav Shira Gaon kotev, ve'amid Rabbi Akiva tamidim harbei, v'yashamda al ha'talmidim sh'Rabbi Akiva, u'ma'atik hu et ha'misoret sheba yivamot. Right, he quotes the Gemara in Yivamot. Pshutol shel lashon. Simple, when you see the language of Vayashamda, Al Tamidim Rabbi Akiva, Mistaber Shehu Mechuvan Hariga Bidei Malchut. Okay? He says that apparently that was Rabbi Shura Gaon's position. And he continues, V'lechor Muchach She'ira Ma'aseh B'Milchemet Bar Kokhba B'Sofa. This apparently happened towards the end of the Bar Kokhba period. Umikan hadaya ma'alechet al tamidim Rabbi Akiva sheyasul milchama ba'amuniyim. Okay. When he continues on, he goes back to the original sources. And in the original sources he says, it's not possible. Because of the timing. Because Rabbi Akiva during the Bar Kokhba period was too early in his career to have so many students, or to have so much influence and so much power. Right, the year 135 was just too early in Rabbi Akiva's career. And he continues, and at the end he sort of leaves this as an open question, which means that what we have today is something interesting, because what we have is this period between Pesach and Shavuot, where the Gaonim saying is a minhag not to get married, where the Torah says, oh, there's also a minhag not to shave, but not to take a haircut. Nobody, up until the tour, nobody here that we've seen has talked about Lag BaOmer. And then you get to the 20th century, and all of a sudden people are talking about the Bar Kokhba rebellion. Okay, so what I'd like to do in the little time that I have left is to take this discussion in two parallel branches. One branch on the halachic side, and the other branch looking at the Lag BaOmer side. Because the historical piece, we don't know. We have two different possibilities over here as to what happened historically, and two different ways of understanding this. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to go just a little bit further, okay? At the bottom of this page, this is a little bit further on the halachic side, okay? The Beit Yosef is written by Rav Yosef Karo. Anybody familiar with his name? He is the guy who wrote the Shulchan Aruch. Before he wrote the Shulchan Aruch, he wrote a Perush on the Tur called the Beit Yosef. He also wrote a Perush on the Rambam called the Kesef Mishnah. Meaning he took a look at the two most central halachic works that had been done and written up until that point, and wrote a perush on each of those. And then once he did that, he says, now I have all the foundations to write my magnum opus, the Shulchan Aruch. Okay? So here he's commenting on what the Tor wrote about Sfirat HaOmer. And he writes as follows. This is at the bottom, underneath the line. Beit Yosef or Achaim. Uma shekatav. When the Tor wrote, "V'yesh mistaprim milag ba'omer va'ilach," that there are some who take haircuts from Lag Ba'omer and onwards. Now he quotes a whole series of Rishonim who said similar things. Rav David Abu Draham, B'shem Ibn Yarchi, Mishmo Shal Haraza, Ibn Shweib, V'shamati. Okay, and he quotes the Abu Draham. V'zeh l'shono at the middle of the second line, V'zayin lamed, V'zeh l'shono. Shamati, I heard. Sheyesh b'midrash. What that means is I heard about this midrash. What does that mean? He didn't see it. So he's basing his explanation based on second-hand information that he heard, and he's not even sure if it's second-hand information because he doesn't know if the person he heard it from heard it firsthand. Shamati, sheyesh b'midrash, shemeitu mipesach ad pros ha'atzeret. I heard that somebody recognizes a midrash that says that they died from Pesach until halfway through the Atzeret. And that turns out to be 15 days before Shavuot. Right? And he goes to explain how the word pros could mean 15 days. Right? And if you take 15 days from Shavuot, what day of the Omer do you get to? Go 15 days backwards, he gets to the 35th day of the Omer, right? And that works out perfectly. For the minhag that says we start getting haircuts again starting on Lag BaOmer. Yeah. From here starts, from this Pekdusim, and as the Yahud Raham starts a very, very long discussion that carries on for a few hundred years about how you work out the minhag of Lag BaOmer on the 33rd day. And that's why there are some who do it only starting from the 34th day, because they say, well, Mitzat Hayom Kukulo, so really it's as if I did 34 full days. But then you have others who say, no, Lag BaOmer is special. Meaning, let's just take the significance of this. Aside from the halachic discussion, the Beit Yosef, who's commenting on why it is that some people start taking haircuts from Lag BaOmer and onwards, or actually from the 34th day of the Omer and onwards, right, is because somebody heard that there's a midrash that says that they only stop dying, that they stop dying 15 days before Shavuot. Which means that according to the Beit Yosef and the sources that he's quoting, which day of the Omer is this special day? The 34th day of the Omer. The 33rd day is the last full day of absolute mourning. But the 34th day of the Omer is when you begin the day with mourning, but you don't have to finish the day with mourning. Is there any notion of joy or happiness over here? No, it's just the cessation of mourning. Why? Because according to something that somebody heard, they stopped dying starting on the 35th day of the Omer. That's a little bit weird. Okay. Underneath that, you have Darkei Moshe. Darkei Moshe was written by somebody by the name of Rav Moshe Isserles. Anybody here ever hear of him? He's also called the Ramah. Okay. He wrote the Ashkenazi comment on the Shulchan Aruch. I mean, the Shulchan Aruch preserved the Sephardi traditions. Rav Moshe Isserles preserved the Ashkenazi traditions as they contrasted with the Sephardi ones. So he wrote a perush on the tour also, called the Darkei Moshe. This was what he wrote as the prelude to what was going to be his magnum opus. He writes as follows: V'haminhag pashut lehistaper b'yom lamed gimel. He says, everybody knows, it's minhag pashut, that we start getting haircuts on the 33rd day of the Omer. Meaning that for Rav Yosef Karo, the 33rd day of the Omer is nothing. It's just the 33rd day of the Omer. But for the Ramah, right, the 33rd day of the Omer is the day you get haircuts, and he ends, Umar bimbo mishteh v'simcha kitzat. And we have a little bit extra food and joy. And that's it. Oh, yeah, and he quotes then the Maharil, who says, yeah, and don't say tachnun on Lag BaOmer either. Yeah, that gives a lot of joy, especially when it comes on our Monday or Thursday, right? So when it comes to the halachic stuff, there's this machloket between Sfarad and Ashkenaz. There's according to Chachmei Sfarad, there's no joy, there's no simcha, and there's no Lag BaOmer. According to Chachmei Ashkenaz, there is Lag BaOmer, and there is a tiny bit of simcha. What's the earliest source for this? So this is what I discovered in an article that I read just yesterday. Okay? Apparently, Lag BaOmer was completely unknown until the 12th century. We didn't see it in Breishit Rabbah. We didn't see it in Gemara Yevamot. We didn't see it in Rav Shura Gaon. We didn't see it in Otzer HaGaonim. The first person to mention Lag BaOmer is in the 12th century, where the Ra'avan, he was an Ashkenazi Rishon, and he says, look, I look around, I see that there's a minhag that people have to have a little bit of simcha on Lag BaOmer. I can't figure out why. But I heard that there's a different version in the Yerushalmi of a text that we don't have in our hands. You hear this? He heard that somebody once saw a text of the Yerushalmi that we no longer have available that said this thing about Pros Ha'atzeret, that 15 days before the end of the Omer is when they stop dying. So the Ra'avan is quoting somebody. This is the source. It's the first source that we have. He's quoting somebody who heard from somebody who said that they had once seen, and that is the basis in the 12th century. That's the only basis that he can offer for this minhag. Now, this is a little bit weird. There is no such source that we are aware of. He also wasn't aware of such a source. He had heard about it second or third hand from somebody who claims, right? Which is weird, which means that the minhag of Lag BaOmer started somewhere, somehow, in Ashkenaz only. Okay? Actually, not even in Ashkenaz, it was France and Germany. Anybody know a little bit of geography? Right? I don't. Okay? France is south of Germany, and between them, we have an area called Provence. Okay? Which was influenced both by France and by Germany. In Germany, they never heard of Lag BaOmer. In Provence, they heard of... Provence is where it started. The Jews in Provence, and they had... They were sort of in the middle. The Jews in Provence, in Minhag, started there. We don't know how, we don't know why. There is absolutely no evidence of when the Minhag started, or how the Minhag started, or who started the Minhag. But we do know where it started, in Provence, that Jews started having a little bit of simcha on Lag BaOmer. From there, something happened. And tracing exactly how it happened isn't clear. But, at least this article that I read yesterday came up with he has one very interesting observation, and then asks a great question. The interesting observation that he came up with was as follows. When did this whole business of the bonfires, or Lag BaOmer as a thing, start? So he traces this. I mean, historians are talking about it in the late 19th, early 20th century. He says that it has to do with the rise of Zionism. Why? Because when you have Sfirat HaOmer, and you have this period of time as a period of mourning, the early Zionists, and going all the way, by the way, until the 1960s and 1970s, so for the first 100 years of Zionism, at least 100 years of political Zionism, you have an entire movement that says that the image of Jews as victims is one that we have to erase from all of Jewish history. We have to create a new image of Jews. Jews are not victims, Jews are fighters. So when early Zionists began looking for models, so they found some really interesting models that became their role models. For example, Masada. Masada was really unknown. For most of Jewish history, nobody knew about Masada. Right? They only discovered it somewhere in the 19th century. But that became a really important part of Zionist culture. Right? Because Masada said, we are not victims. You are not going to take our lives. We are going to beat you at your own game. That was Masada. It was an image of the new Jew, the Jew as the fighter. Apparently, the Zionist youth camps in Europe in the late 19th century began to adopt Lag BaOmer. Why? Because Lag BaOmer existed as a thing. It was a day of a little bit of simcha, but they connected very much with the whole Bar Kokhba rebellion. Bar Kokhba rebellion gave them a model. So what did they do? They began doing all sorts of things like paramilitary training in the forests. Now, we paramilitary training at night. You have to light a fire to keep yourself warm, especially since you're talking about Europe. And people go shooting. And they didn't have guns, so they would shoot with bows and arrows. Anybody here ever go with bows and arrows? Okay, I see a number of hands. When I was growing up, that was what we did. Lag BaOmer was a day for sports competitions with bows and arrows. And there are lots of records of late 19th century people doing bows and arrows on Lag BaOmer. Why? Because that was part of the pre-Zionist, pre-military training of guess who we're going to identify with? We're going to identify with the fighters of Bar Kokhba. And what they did was they took a story that appeared in Bereishit Rabbah, it appears again in the Gemara, and they decided to adopt that story. But the story now is no longer about the Talmidim who didn't behave nicely to each other. The story got now interpreted as Rabbi Akiva's followers, not his students, but the followers who got killed. So we are going to reclaim the tradition of Rabbi Akiva's fighters. So they started doing all these things. That's where the bonfire started. Everybody has a bonfire out in the woods someplace, and the competitions, the physical competitions, the sports competitions, and the bow and arrow. Because they're reclaiming the image of the Bar Kokhba rebellion from who knows how much earlier. Eventually, that became adopted here in Israel and as an integral part of the Israeli culture. Which is why when you go all over the place, people are making bonfires in every street corner. It doesn't happen in Australia, it doesn't happen in England, it doesn't happen in the US. I mean, mostly because they have fire codes in all these civilized countries. But here, one night a year, there's an exception. Now, and because it became an integral part of the Zionist culture. Here's a weird thing. In contemporary Israeli culture, there are two versions of Lag BaOmer. There's the secular version of Lag BaOmer, and there's the Haredi version of Lag BaOmer. The secular version of Lag BaOmer is when kids go out and burn their school books. If you went to an Israeli bonfire last night, you would see kids taking their math books and tearing out the pages and throwing them into the bonfire and they burn their school books, which is an extraordinary inversion of the Rabbi Akiva story. Right? What's Rabbi Akiva all about? Rabbi Akiva is about his Talmidim, right? And here you have Talmidim who are basically rebelling against the whole culture of learning. But that's bizarre. And that's the secular Lag BaOmer. I saw it last night. I'm sitting there, I'm watching. I'm over here, there's another fire right around where Aryeh is sitting. and there are kids there. They just don't, they're math books. They want to savor, so they take one page at a time, and they're tossing one page at a time into the fire, which to me is horrific, because not only is it an inversion of Rabbi Akiva, but, you know, the image of burning books, we have a long history with that, and it's not a really positive one. So that's the secular version of Lag BaOmer in modern Israel. The Haredi version of it, and that's new, it's like, you know, the last 15, 20 years. The Haredi version of Lag BaOmer in Israel is also new. 40 years ago, it was unknown to have thousands of people going to Meron. The fact that there were 400,000 people at that festival in Meron is a completely new invention. What happened, somewhere at the end of the 16th century, people actually used to do a bonfire on the anniversary of the death of Shmuel HaNavi. Right outside Yerushalayim, there's a place called Nebi Samuel. That's where, according to the Mesorah, according to the Arab Mesorah, that Shmuel HaNavi is buried there. Okay, they used to go there. And that was on the 28th day of Iyar. That's coming up pretty soon. Next week, I think. Another week and a half. The 28th day of Iyar. Which is nowadays is Yom Yerushalayim. 28th day of Iyar was the yard site of Shmuel HaNavi. They would go make a little bonfire. Now, you have to understand, how many Jews are living in Yerushalayim in the 16th century? How many Jews are living in Israel in the 16th century?
Less than
that. I mean, a few hundred at most. Yeah, you have a handful in Yerushalayim, a handful in Galil, in Tzfat. I think that's it. So you have maybe a dozen people or so, maybe two dozen people who are going to the Kever of Shmuel HaNavi. What happens is that the Muslims get upset about this and they shut down the practice. So the Jews went to a place that was much further away where the Muslims wouldn't bother them, and they went and they found a Kever up on Har Meron. And they started doing stuff there. Right? And it moved somehow or another from the day of Shmuel HaNavi's Yartzeit to Lag BaOmer. Lag BaOmer was a day that existed but had no substance to it. And nobody knew what the substance was. The only thing they knew was that there's a minhag that starting on Lag BaOmer for Ashkenazim you can take haircuts, and for Sfaradim starting after Lag BaOmer. So you had this day that nobody knew where it came from. Apparently it started somewhere in Provence. And they had this ritual. So you have a day without a ritual, and a ritual without a day. So they moved the ritual to Lag BaOmer, and they moved it from Nebi Samuel all the way to Meron. For the next few hundred years, you have a handful of people who are following this little Mesorah in Meron, where they light a fire and they dance around the fire, singing songs. Up until you get to the end, the second half of the 20th century. And in the second half of the 20th century, with the influence of Hasidut, with the influence of Kabbalah, right, and that's why the two groups who go there really are, and did anybody go yesterday? Right? Which two groups are most are represented? Mostly Hasidim and Sephardim. Probably had a ton of Moroccans. They may not have been in the same place as the Hasidim. Okay, but a ton of Moroccans up there. Why? Because they were profoundly influenced by the Kabbalah. Right? Once it moved to Tzfat, Meron is right next to Tzfat. Once it moved to Tzfat, at the end of the 16th century, we're talking about the heyday of Kabbalah. Now, when it first started, they did it there because it was an accessible place on a day that was available, because it was a day on the Jewish calendar that needed meaning to it. And then somebody said something about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. In the beginning, they couldn't decide if they were celebrating the day of his birth, the day of his death, the day that he started learning Torah, the day that he came out of the cave. There are a lot of different traditions about this. Meaning, the practice preceded any explanation for the practice. Just like in Provence, the practice preceded the explanation for the practice. And then, over the course of the next few hundred years, with the influence of Kabbalah, and with the influence of Hasidut, which is also very heavily influenced by the Kabbalah, the second half of the 20th century, when Hasidut becomes popularized, and when Kabbalah becomes popularized, so the event at Har Meron becomes popularized, and you have 400,000 people gathering together for an event that they don't understand what they're doing, why they're doing it, why they're doing it on that particular day. But it is the largest single public event in Israel every single year. And that's pretty crazy. Okay, Yosef Aryeh, you've been wanting to say something for a while. Where were you switching?
So you're saying it's the Muslims' fault?
I didn't say fault, it could be to their credit. Because like, otherwise, imagine all those people converging on Yerushalayim. That'd be Samuel. Okay? I think that this story is an amazing story. It's an amazing story for a lot of reasons. About how halakha evolves over the course of time. And sometimes we know how it evolves, and sometimes we don't know where it comes from. How minhagim evolve over the course of time. And how great public celebrations sometimes are invented by people who know nothing. I'm gonna just finish this with a vignette, one tiny little story. If you travel around the Galil, especially around the area of Har Meron, but anywhere in the upper Galil, you travel around, and every few kilometers you see a sign that says Kever Rabbi, something or another, right? Rabbi Hanina ben Chachinai, Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa, right? There are dozens, if not hundreds, of kvarot that are marked up there as Kever so-and-so. 100 years ago, those signs didn't exist, obviously. 50 years ago, those signs didn't exist. 50 years ago, when you passed by, yes, what's that? They said, some sheikh is buried there. Because you look, and it looks like an Arab burial house. Square, you know, a little building, square, with a dome on top of it. What's the story? It goes like this. Number one, we have no clue who's buried in these places. Zero clue. There are some, two or three, about which there is a very, very ancient Mesorah, right? I think the Kever of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is probably one of them. But aside from those few, I think Kever HaRambam, there's a pretty respectable Mesorah on that in Tveria. There are a few others. Here's what happened. There's no doubt that there are Tanaim buried all over the Galil. That's where they lived. That's where they died. Chances are that people for many, many years marked those burial places as special places. When the Muslims came, so I don't know a lot about Islam, but this much I do know. When the Muslims came, so Muslims, before they became politicized, had a tremendous amount of respect for other religions. So Nabi Musa is Hanavi Moshe. And Nabi Arun is Hanavi Aaron. They believe that Moshe is a Navi, and Aaron was a Navi. And they have tremendous respect. You go to Iraq, and you have the burial places of of some of the Nevi'im. Okay? What happened? Any place that was revered by any religion, they basically said, well, Islam has to supersede all other religions. So what they did was, they basically converted all those places to Islam. So if there was a place that there was an ancient Mesorah about somebody who was buried, they went and they built a building on top of it. And they, you know what these buildings look like? It's a small square building with a dome on top of it. And they called it Kever Sheikh, right? Something or another. They gave it a name that was the Kever of some Arab Sheikh. And that way they preserved it. So because they preserved these places, so that's how we know that these were actually places that were revered by other people. But for the Arabs, they're all called Kever Sheikh. About 40 years ago, a group of guys, one or two guys, who called themselves, I think, the Association for the Reclamation of Kivrei Tzadikim, or Kivrei Tanaim V'Amoraim. They went around, and they stuck signs, almost at random. And each one of those Kever Sheikhs all of a sudden got the name of some Tana. They went around marking every one of those places. So you go around in the Galil, and there are dozens of Kever Tana this, and Kever Tana this, and Kever Tana this. And we have no clue who's buried where, or why, or how. Okay? It's another one of those examples how things that later on became sanctified by people, like there are, I know people who go to Kever Dan. Why Dan would be buried in Eretz Yisrael, I have no idea. He died in Egypt. But they go to Kever Dan. They claim it's in the area of Dan. Okay, what happened? It's the same thing. Right? There was somebody important who had been buried someplace, right, in the area of the Shvela, in the area of Shevet Dan, where Dan, by the way, never really lived. But and then, in the Muslim conquest, they said, this is a holy place, we're going to call it Kever Sheikh something. And then, somewhere in the 20th century, some Jew came along and said, Kever Dan, because it's in the Nachala of Dan, and it became now a place to migrate to as the Kever of Dan. Okay? So here we have burial places with names on them. We don't know who's really buried there. We have holidays with celebrations, and we don't know why the holiday is considered a holiday, and we don't know why the celebration came to be that celebration. It's almost like a strange conflation of influences. And yet we have the day that is one of the most significant days on the religious calendar in contemporary Israel. That's weird. Okay, so I didn't come here today to destroy Lag BaOmer in your eyes, even if that's what happened. What I actually came was to open a question. So what do you do with it now? Do we say, bah humbug, the whole thing is just a bunch of bunk built on nothing that nobody knows? And by the way, nowadays, you know, in Hasidut, you can find volumes and volumes that are written about Lag BaOmer and how significant it is and the importance, the Yulad Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, all of which was written in the last few hundred years to explain a day and a celebration that was invented in the 16th century. The day was invented in the 12th century, celebrations were invented in the late 16th century. So do we say it's all just a bunch of bunk? Or do we say that Minhag Yisrael carries a certain power to it? And even if the Minhag started in a way that was strange and weird, you know, there's something about it that we value and cherish, and we should adhere to it. That's a great question. As they say, Lag Sameach.